From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Penn and Teller, we feature interviews with the eccentric magic and comedy team. They have a new weekly variety show that premiered this month on the FX cable network. Also, advice on dealing with the threat of violence. We talk with Gavin DeBecker, an expert on stalkers, domestic violence, and violence in the workplace. He's the author of The Gift of Fear, Survival Signals That Protect Us from Violence, which is now out in paperback. And John Powers reviews the new movie, Your Friends and Neighbors, by the same writer-director who made In the Company of Men. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Administration officials say the U.S. attack against suspected terrorist sites marks the beginning of a long-term battle against the terrorist network responsible for the bombings of the two U.S. embassies in Africa. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says the attack was a preemptive measure. The Pentagon is hoping to have some damage assessments today from the cruise missile attacks on a suspected terrorist training camp in Afghanistan and a suspected chemical plant in Sudan. The attack was launched from ships in the Arabian Sea and the Red Sea, as NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
An administration official said between 75 and 100 cruise missiles were launched nearly simultaneously. The target in Afghanistan was a compound where the Islamic militant Osama bin Laden was suspected of training terrorists. The target in Sudan was a pharmaceutical plant where officials believe a precursor chemical was being produced to make a deadly nerve agent. Officials say bin Laden had been working with the Sudanese to produce the chemical. U.S. officials blame bin Laden for the August 7th bombings in Kenya and Tanzania that left hundreds dead and thousands injured. U.S. officials do fear there may be retaliation from terrorist groups for the U.S. strikes overseas. The FBI has also warned local law enforcement to be on a higher state of alert. Martha Raddatz, NPR News, Washington.
Taliban officials say the U.S. missile attacks on a base in Afghanistan killed at least 21 people, and Pakistan says one of the missiles landed on its soil, killing at least 5 people. After the attacks, gunmen seriously injured 2 United Nations workers in the Afghan capital. Security has been tightened at federal buildings around the nation today in the wake of the missile attack, and in New York City, while few details have been disclosed, security has been increased at airports and public buildings, as NPR's Margot Adler reports.
Although he refused to discuss details, Police Commissioner Howard Safer issued a Condition Bravo alert, ordering police to look out for strange packages. He also increased police presence at the United Nations and at other UN missions, consulates, and government buildings. Security was also tightened at both Kennedy and LaGuardia airports, as well as at some high tourist spots like St. Patrick's Cathedral. Mayor Rudolph Giuliani called the measures routine and precautionary and emphasized that there were no reports suggesting that New York was a specific target. Meanwhile, Osama bin Laden, the alleged terrorist in the attacks on the U.S. embassies in Africa, is already the target of an ongoing investigation in New York. A federal grand jury here is looking into his alleged role in financing the World Trade Tower bombings and other crimes. According to the Daily News, if bin Laden is ever indicted for the embassy bombings, it may well be here. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
There's been a sharp downdraft on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently down 232 points in heavy trading of 331 million shares. The S&P 500 is down 30, and the Nasdaq Composite Index is down 60%. That's more than 3%. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, investors appear to be heading for the exits on Wall Street today amid new worries about economic weakness abroad. NPR's Jack Spear joins us live now with the latest.
Political and economic uncertainties in both Asia and Russia, along with tensions on the world stage, are making for a rough end of the week for Wall Street. Investors are bailing out of bank stocks. That's over fears problems in Russia could impact on earnings. Citibank, Chase, and J.P. Morgan are all lower today. Add to that Wall Street's worries over a host of other matters, and you've got what Aubrey Jones chief economist Alan Skranka says is a recipe for selling.
Investors are very anxious. They have a lot to worry about, and when they worry, they sell stocks, whether it's what's going on with President Clinton, the uncertainty with the Asian situation that's now spilling over into other countries. And when you start shooting missiles, then that makes everybody nervous.
In other news today, electrical connector company AMP announced its board has rejected a $10 billion hostile takeover bid from Allied Signal. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
As stocks sag today, bond prices are on the rise in a flight to safety. The yield on the benchmark 30-year Treasury bond is down to a record low, 5.45%. Russia's parliament has sharply criticized the government's handling of that country's financial crisis. The Duma, which is dominated by opposition lawmakers, has called for President Boris Yeltsin to resign. The country's new prime minister has defended the government's actions and warned that Russia is just entering a serious financial crisis. A federal mediator has recessed talks between U.S. West and the union representing its striking workers. No time has been set for a resumption of the negotiations. As the strike moved into its sixth day, there was no indication on whether the two sides have moved any closer on the contentious issues of forced overtime and health benefits. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The eccentric magic and comedy duo Penn and Teller have a new weekly variety show that premiered this month on the FX cable network. It's called Penn and Teller's Sin City Spectacular, and it's broadcast from Las Vegas, where they live. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from Penn and Teller. Penn and Teller actually don't like to be described as performing magic and comedy. They prefer tricks, cons, and swindles. Pretty amazing ones. Penn is the tall, husky juggler and card shark who provides the narrations, jokes, and verbal abuse. Teller is the magician who never speaks on stage. First, we'll hear from Penn in an interview we recorded back in 1987. He's described their shows as magic for people who hate magic acts. I asked what kind of magic he hated.
When people picture magic, they picture that kind of old guy in a tux pushing women in bad bikinis into boxes. While playing, you know, Star Wars music or something. And there's a whole lot of people that would like what we do that wouldn't like the standard magic things. Was just the most important thing was to get that image of pushing women around out of people's minds so that we could do what we do.
In your shows, you sometimes make it seem like magic and juggling are a lot of showmanship. And then after you've told the audience that, then you really make it come alive and make it seem truly magical.
Well, I really believe that there's a philosophy in magic that is in really all of magic. There's a level of condescension. The I can do something that you can't, and the problem with that theory is that when you're doing the show, you have people in your audience that can do heart surgery and fix motorcycles. I mean, program computers. And I think that in no other form of performance do people come out and have that kind of chip on their shoulder. So we take for granted that every single person in our audience, when they were 12 or 13 years old, read one magic book and learned one magic trick and take that as a given. And I don't like that kind of Doug Henning coming out and saying, oh, just suspend all your disbelief and be children for a while. We don't want children in our audience. We want people to come with a real chip on their shoulder and knowing that what we're doing is swindling, because that's where the real fun of it is.
I'm sure a lot of magicians don't like you calling magic swindling and tricks. Do you get some negative reactions from some of the older magicians?
We try so hard to be bad boys, and we try so hard to make people like Harry Blackstone Jr. and Henning and Copperfield angry at us. But unfortunately, they're such professionals, and they're so good at what they do. I think they understand completely what it is we're trying to do. The only problems we've had, and we have had problems, has been with amateurs. Because they read the books and they take rules that are simply learning tools and act like they were moral rules.
Magicians and jugglers frequently wear, you know, capes and hats, and there's this whole costuming for that profession. And you guys started off performing, well, you would wear T-shirts and jeans, as I remember, mm-hmm. and Teller used to wear tights.
Yeah.
And now you both wear three-piece suits, which I can't think of anybody else who's ever worn three-piece suits in a magic kind of show. Well, how did you get the idea to dress that way?
There's a fascinating piece of history that ties in with this. When you picture the standard magician, you picture top hat and tails. Now, the reason you picture that is in the late 19th century, when magic was really flourishing in Europe, a magician got the brilliant idea that what he was going to do was to dress just like his audience, which at that time was top hat and tails. And then years went by, and all the technology of magic was built around how you can hide a bird inside the tails of a tailcoat. And magicians held on to that, and the basic idea behind it was completely lost. Teller and I decided that it would put more emphasis on us and what we were doing, and after all, the show is Penn and Teller, and it is unabashedly about us, if we took away anything people could hold on to. So we're wearing the clothes that are the closest, if not to our audience, then the closest to invisible. It makes people have to deal with us. They can't say, oh, that guy's wearing a sweater. That's the kind of guy he is. You know, he's wearing this kind of clothes. He's a Robin Williams kind of guy. He's wearing a leather jacket. He's a Bruce Springsteen kind of guy. You can't do that at all with a suit coat. And also the fact that I think that with our difference in sizes, the fact that we're dressed identical always makes me smile. It's kind of a monkey's thing happening there, you know.
In a cable special that you and Teller did, you ran your own magic store. That's how the story started. And I wonder if you still hang out in magic stores a lot, if that's still as much fun as it used to be.
We do go occasionally. I never hung out that much. Teller did very, very much in his youth. And what we had felt every time that a magic store was portrayed on television or in movies, it was always portrayed as a very mystical, wonderful Tinkerbell-type place. And the angle we wanted to give to it, which I think is the wonderful angle, is essentially a magic store is some old guy ripping off children. And the magic store had never been, I had never seen one in a movie or television that was dirty. But Invisible Thread is a little bit of a love letter to the cheesy, sleazy guys that really run those magic stores. And the nice thing was the magic store that Teller hung out in, which was a magic store in New York that he hung out with when he was a kid, the man who owned it came to see Invisible Thread. Teller invited him to the screening, and afterwards he said, you know, that's just what I do. You guys really nailed it, you know? That Copperfield does this trick. I use that line all the time. It was just wonderful that he recognized what we were really trying to do. And so I think that I've unfortunately outgrown it a little bit, and also I can't go into a magic store and be taken anymore, and that's what I liked most about it. So I guess the answer is, in actuality, I don't really visit magic stores, but in my head, I do an awful lot. I have wonderful, fond memories of that cheesiness.
Penn Jillette recorded in 1987. He and his partner, Teller, have a new weekly variety show on the FX cable network. We're going to hear an interview recorded with Teller last year. Teller not only performs incredible feats of magic, like staying in a water tank longer than Houdini, he brings grace and intelligence to his art. On the other hand, he performs a lot of very funny magic intended to satirize all the cliches of the form. Teller doesn't speak on stage, and he used to refuse to do interviews. I asked him why he's become more comfortable speaking in public about his work.
Over the years, we've grown to trust our audience more. It used to be that when I was in the lobby, I would stay silent after the show. And then it gradually dawned on us that the entire audience knows perfectly well that I can talk. And it was kind of a sign of respect to when they said, "And we enjoyed your show," to say, "Thank you." And that's been extending over the years, and to the point where I've done print interviews for a long time. And then I started to do little pieces on NPR on All Things Considered. Now here I am with you.
How did you start not talking in your performances?
The first I remember not talking was when I was actually about maybe 10 or 11 and going out for Halloween. And I discovered that if I didn't talk, people never recognized me in my Halloween costume. They always recognized my voice, which was very distinctive to them. You know, I mean, what is 10 people on the same street? Of course, they're going to recognize my voice. And then, as I began to work more in theater and magic, I became really interested in plot, and I started to pay attention to what magicians usually said. And what they usually said was things like, "Here I have a red ball. Now I'm placing it into my left hand. And now, lo, it is gone." All stuff that the audience could see for itself. So it became obvious to me that there ought to be a level of any piece of performance, especially any piece of magical performance, that people can perceive by watching it. So I thought this was a kind of interesting challenge because nobody was doing it at the time at all. And I began to work on this with a college drama professor of mine. I went to Amherst College, and I conned the drama department into doing a course called The Figure of the Magician in Dramatic Literature. Right, right. You know, what we this is Teller works on his magic act with a pretty cool drama professor. And we worked on several pieces that were silent. I then tried the silent stuff at the fraternity parties and found miraculously that if I had gone in and started to try to shout down the crowd,
yeah,
you know, I would have been heckled to death. Go in, don't say a damn thing, shine spotlight, little spotlights on you, turn off all the other lights in the room, and lo and behold, the frat boys would momentarily remove their hands from their girlfriends' breasts, set down their cups of beer, and pay attention.
Now, since you didn't speak in your performances, since you don't speak in your performances, were you ever afraid you'd be confused with a mime?
Well, mimes generally don't use props, and mimes generally have their faces painted white and behave much like a piece of sugar candy. And I don't think anybody's apt to confuse me with that because, among other things, I'm very unconscious of exterior manifestations of what I'm thinking. That is, I don't think about making faces. I don't think about holding positions. And mime is sort of more akin to dance in that, you know, where people do think about their postures and the shapes they're making. I just think about the evil thoughts I'm thinking. and that's how I work.
You have evil thoughts in your head when you're performing?
Oh, very often, yes.
Like what?
Well, in the show, you know, one of the things that I've done for the longest time is to slash a rose to bits by cutting its shadow apart. There's a sort of a white paper screen and a rose in front of it and a little lamp, and the lamp casts the shadow of the rose on the screen, and wherever I slash through the paper of the screen, the corresponding portion of the rose withers and dies. There are very evil thoughts that go through your head when you're doing that. The punchline to that, which I'm very proud of because not that many pieces of magic have a good twist at the end, is that I accidentally prick my finger with the knife. And when I'm holding my hand out to look at the wound, the shadow bleeds. There's lots of evil thoughts around that.
Now, tell me more about why you got into this kind of malevolent side of magic, thinking evil thoughts with magic. Because magic, for a lot of people, is just this kind of pure delight and, you know, very kind of joyful and
insipid.
Yes, right. Yes.
Joyful and insipid or fraudulently mystical. I like drama. I like drama. It's very simple. And I always have. The things that have attracted me have never been frivolous sorts of comedies, you know. My favorite movie is Psycho. My favorite play is Oedipus Rex. My favorite Shakespearean play is Macbeth. My favorite short story writer is Poe. That's just me. I don't know that I pulled magic in that direction so much as I was pulled in that direction by those desires. And I've found a curious thing, which is that the darker the thought that I'm thinking, the funnier the audience finds it.
Uh-huh.
It reminds me of the curse of Cassandra. I think Apollo came down and offered to make love to Cassandra, the Greek maiden. She turned him down, and he cursed her. And the curse was she would always make correct prophecies, and no one would ever believe her. And that's kind of the way I feel when I'm thinking the darkest of thoughts and the audience is laughing its head off. And I'm happy, though.
My guest is Teller. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition, we're listening to an interview I recorded last fall with Teller of the magic and comedy team Penn and Teller. We spoke just before their TV special, Home Invasion. I asked Teller about one of the tricks on the show. One of the things you do is you get into the water tank. This is something you've done on stage, but in this show you're doing it in a family's living room. And do the setup for us. Describe what's happening in this.
Well, we have sent a family out of their house. We've gotten their consent to be on a television show. They don't know anything about what we're going to do. So we sent them out of their house and set up our lights and set up our water tank, which is, I think it looks like a phone booth full of water, in their living room. And it's an unpleasant looking thing because I am inside the water tank and I am locked in there with bars keeping me from getting my face to the surface of the water. We then draped this entire thing with a piece of fabric. So they just saw this red monolith in their living room, brought them back in and sat them down. And Penn announced that he was going to do a little bit of close-up magic, something very un-Penn and Tellery, just a piece of close-up magic. But to keep the home audience interested, at which point he whips away the sheet, revealing me in the water tank, Teller, he says, will hold his breath until Penn finds the correct selected card. This is something we do on stage, and it's pretty effective. But putting it in somebody's living room and having them suddenly find a couple of hundred gallons of water in a large tank in the middle of their living room with a man holding his breath in a life and death situation is quite another
thing. While a card trick is being done.
And also in the theater, you know, there's something about the frame of a theater that makes you know that everything's going to come out just fine in the end. Well, when it's happening in your living room where real things happen, it has quite a different feel. And as the plot unfolds, Penn fails to find the card, but I insist on remaining in the water tank. And Penn acknowledges my heroic insistence to remain in the water tank and then ignores me while I completely drown. And the thing ends up with Penn shrugging and basically telling the people that from now on it's a pretty easy trick as this corpse is floating there in their living room and leaving them in their living room with it's 4 or 5 people with a large tank of water and Teller's corpse. And the final moments of the show are just very pleasant in watching these people trying to deal with the fact that they now have a corpse in their living room.
Which makes the trick even better because, of course, you're not dead, which means that you are under that water even longer than we could have ever imagined you'd be able to survive there. You've been under so long that you're forced to play dead to be credible.
It's exceedingly unpleasant to do.
I was going to ask you that, especially I should point out you're wearing a suit and tie, your standard, you know, theatrical garb, in that water tank. So in addition to what you must be going through with air, you know, you're wearing a suit and tie in there.
The suit and tie doesn't bother
nothing,
me very much.
Huh?
Nothing compared with the strain on my lungs.
Tell me what it feels like. I have no clue how you make this trick work.
Mm.
But whatever it is, I'm sure it's not pleasant.
No, it's not. If it were only the claustrophobia of being in that confinement,
it would just be like an MRI.
yeah. That would still be pretty unpleasant.
Yeah.
But I'm used to it now. You know, I've done that thing for 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
And I've grown comfortable with it, and all the physical things that I need to have good and strong and workable are very comfortable and workable now. When I first tried it, it was very strenuous. The first time we ever did it was on national television on Saturday Night Live, and there were serious problems that very first performance. And if you should ever see it in rebroadcast on TV, they do close-ups of my face, and my eyes look very full of anxiety, and they are very full of anxiety. Now, not actually full of anxiety over death; they're full of anxiety over embarrassment, because we never do anything that would actually risk my death or Penn's death. It's extremely important if you're going to do dangerous things to always have several levels of safety precaution on them. And in that particular one, on Saturday Night Live, there was a particular gesture that if I made this gesture, one of our assistants would run out, unlock the tank, and drag out my waterlogged body before I had a chance to drown.
You just tell me one thing about the water tank. How much of that really depends on you holding your breath for a long time? Or breathing in a most minimal way.
You're asking questions about how we're doing the trick? Is that what you're asking?
Do I get punished by the Magicians Union
for
this?
No, you don't. You just get reminded that a good piece of the pleasure in watching one of these things is wondering how real it is. You know, that's really an interesting feature about watching a magical performance. It isn't just wondering how it's done. It's wondering where reality leaves off and trick begins. That's one of the most interesting things, and it's one of the things that magic can teach. it's, you know, every kid goes through a magic phase. And they go through a magic phase when they're about 10. Did you not, at some point when you were 10, read a biography of Houdini?
Not. Or, I didn't.
You didn't?
No.
Well?
I think I had an uncle who took pennies and nickels out of my ear, and that was like, no way.
That,
I'm not going near this thing.
That may have been a product of I think when I was growing up, not all young women went through that. They now do. What happens is you get to about the age of 10 and you realize that maybe the Easter Bunny wasn't real, which means that maybe adults sometimes lie to you. And the power of prevarication is very attractive. And if you are a kid with good morals, you then say, well, I'm going to learn about this through art. And, of course, the perfect form of art to do that with is magic. If you're a kid without morals, that's when you start shoplifting.
So, anyways, we're just going to let me wonder about
yes,
where that line is.
We're going to let you wonder, but not without saying that magic seems to have a very useful function in society, and that useful function consists in making people realize that even when people are lying straight in their faces and saying, I am lying, that they can still be fooled. And that means that when they turn on their TV the next time and someone lies straight in their faces, someone dressed usually exactly like Penn and Teller in gray business suits, they view it with a little more skepticism. And that's a very salutary effect.
Your act has always been billed as magic for people who hate magic. Did I say something wrong?
Yes, actually. There are those who respond to it and who refer to it as the magic show for people who hate magic shows. But by and large, we don't call it a magic show, and for good and sufficient reason. Because when you say magic, what do you think? You think, you know, greasy guy in a tux with a lot of birds. And
wait. And
yes,
a semi-clad woman beside him.
Beside him, doing all the work. Very unflatteringly dressed, usually, or flatteringly dressed in the basest possible way. Doesn't it strike you very strange that feminists have not protested magic shows? You know, being that, what do we see in magic shows? We see women mutilated, right? We see women in subservient and debased roles. We see any woman brought on stage by a male magician is implicitly raped, by and large, you know. By and large, the actual attitude is, "Hey, honey, can I? Let's see, what's your name, Julie? Can I call you Julie? Sure. What time? You know, that kind of just horrendous joke. This is what people think of when they think of magic.
Taylor, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. What fun.
Our interview with Teller was recorded last year. Penn and Teller have a new weekly variety show called Penn and Teller's Sin City Spectacular on the FX cable network. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, letting fear protect you. We talk with Gavin DeBecker, author of The Gift of Fear. He advises Supreme Court justices, movie stars, corporations, and abortion clinics about dealing with the threat of violence. And film critic John Powers reviews Your Friends and Neighbors. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When a person turns violent and opens fire on people at work, kills a spouse, or rapes a stranger, that violence usually doesn't come out of nowhere, according to my guest Gavin DeBecker. He's in the business of predicting who is likely to become violent or follow through on a threat. He consults on stalkers, death threats, domestic violence, and violence in the workplace. His clients have included Supreme Court justices, movie stars, athletes, elected officials, abortion clinics, corporations, and police departments. He's also served on the Presidential Advisory Board at the Department of Justice. DeBecker is the author of the bestseller The Gift of Fear, which offers advice on protecting yourself from violence. It was recently published in paperback. When we spoke last year, he told me he can't advise people to always comply with an attacker or to always resist. Every situation is different. What he does advise is trust your intuition. I asked him why.
Well, because like every creature on earth, you've got this astounding God-given ability to protect your own safety, to know when you're in the presence of danger. And your intuition takes all the advice, the people who said always comply, always resist, the newspaper article you read, the story you heard from a friend, the advice you saw on the local news. It takes it all and applies it in the only context that really matters, which is the context of the situation you find yourself in then and there.
Do you feel that people act on their intuition without even realizing that they're acting on it?
Many people do, and certainly we act on our fear without realizing that we're really doing it and without thinking about it first. I hope that my work gives people permission to listen to it more often without debate, because the other side of that coin is people hesitate to listen to it. And, you know, while we're cleverly defying our intuition, we're ending up as very frequent victims of violence and accidents.
You have a lot of, I think, really interesting signs to watch out for, signs that you're actually being set up by somebody, and they're kind of trying to assess whether you'll be a good victim or not, and they're trying to set you up to be their victim. I want to run through some of these warning signs, which I think are really interesting. You call one of them forced teaming. What is this?
Well, all of these strategies are strategies of persuasion, and they're used by predatory criminals, and they're also used by other people in different contexts. But if it is used on a woman in a vulnerable situation or a situation where she is alone with someone that she doesn't know or doesn't want to be with, then they're all real important to know about. And forced teaming is basically giving someone or trying to give them the impression that we share a predicament together, so that we have a kind of we're in the same boat attitude. An example would be, hey, aren't we a pair both stuck here in the rain without an umbrella? Well, I would hope a victim would say, or think at least, you don't have an umbrella, and I don't have an umbrella. There's no we don't have an umbrella. And there's a story in the book of a man who says, hey, we've got a hungry cat upstairs, because he sees that a woman has cat food in her shopping bag. And in fact, you know, I have a cat and you may have a cat, but we don't have a hungry cat. He does that because it will make it harder for a woman to rebuff him when there is this sense of some shared experience or we're in the same boat kind of experience.
I know I've been in the position sometimes of like turning down somebody who wanted to do a favor because I distrusted this stranger's motives. And the stranger can come back at you with something like, oh, you're just like too stuck up to accept a favor, or boy, you're the most untrusting person I've ever met. And you
right.
don't know how to respond to that. Should you start being, you know, nicer because you've just been insulted and maybe you have unfairly dismissed somebody's courtesy?
Well, that's certainly what he is trying to do. That strategy is called typecasting, and it's where you give a woman a small insult that she can fix easily. Like an example would be saying, you're probably too fancy a woman to go out with a guy like me. And now to prove that you're not too fancy a woman, then you'll continue to talk to somebody who you might otherwise not want to talk to. Or somebody who says, you don't seem like the kind of woman who reads the newspaper, and now a woman may feel like, oh, I have to show him how smart I am. And what I tell people is that the nature of those little insults or typecasting is, you know, as a predatory strategy, he is just trying to continue and extend the encounter. And you may win the little point of demonstrating to him that, no, you actually do read the newspaper, but you lose the bigger war, which is that you still have someone in your environment who you don't want in your environment.
There's something you call loan sharking.
Yes, loan sharking is probably the most common strategy and the one that people are most familiar with. That is basically offering to help someone when they didn't ask for help. so that they then owe you at least the courtesy of continuing to talk to you. I mean, the typical example is, can I help you with those groceries? And then whether or not you accept the help, I've done this nice thing, so you can't be rude to me now by rebuffing me or by excluding me from conversation. And it's another one of the strategies that is used all the time to extend the encounter and give a predatory criminal the opportunity to evaluate the situation and, above all, evaluate you.
Women so often don't want to be rude. And I mean, sometimes on a bus or a train, someone will sit down next to you who's very frightening to you even, and you won't change your seat because you figure, well, this person might be a very nice, unfortunate person, and you'd be being rude. What advice do you have to women who may actually be putting themselves in jeopardy by being polite?
Well, rudeness is so relative. You know, what I hope to do is to give people a whole new way to think about that, because people are so concerned that being rude might make a man angry, you know, reasoning that they could turn someone whose intent was favorable into someone dangerous just by not being open to their discussions or their approach. And I'm glad to tell people that it is impossible in the context of an unwanted approach from a stranger to transform an ordinary, decent man into a rapist or a killer. And then on the other side, thankfully, it is possible to transform yourself into a person who responds to the signals and thus is a less likely victim. You know, we teach kids now that a stranger who approaches you is a problem. And I want to teach adults that a stranger who approaches a woman in a remote area is himself doing something rude, because it is known, it is predictable, that that would cause her discomfort or fear. The approach is rude. So in context, it's not rude to say to somebody, hey, I'd rather not talk.
You know, you talk about relying on your intuition, but I think there are times when you might confuse intuition with deeply ingrained stereotyping or racism. And you might find yourself in an encounter with somebody who is of a different ethnic group or race or religion than you, and you feel like, oh, you intuitively distrust this person, when what's really happening is that you're just acting on deeply ingrained racist feelings that you were brought up with. And you don't want that to happen.
No, it's a great point. And what I hope people come away with here is that demographics are absolutely irrelevant to safety. Demographics are for pollsters and odds makers. It makes no difference to you in the situation you're in whether the person whose behavior concerns you is black or white. No difference whatsoever. What matters is that you can see the pre-incident indicators. You can see the signals that human beings send each other prior to violence and as part of violent encounters. And it is about predicting human behavior, not demographics. And it's a very good point you raise, because people do have in their minds all sorts of information from things they saw on the local TV news that aren't necessarily relevant to their circumstance and the context of their situation. We may say, oh, well, this is one of those demographic groups that's more likely to hurt me. But while you're thinking about the, you know, the black man who may hurt you, and you're focused on that, you will fail to see the strategies of the white or Hispanic or Oriental person whose behavior is the issue.
I think that behavior is in some ways getting really hard to predict. For instance, you say that, like, if you're a woman walking alone and you feel like somebody might be following you, instead of furtively turning your head and giving them a kind of hidden glance to see if there's really somebody there or not, you should turn around, stare the person in the face in this really no-nonsense way. I would argue, though, that then you risk this person feeling like you've dissed them in some way. And, you know, how many times do you read in the paper or hear about on the news somebody who shot somebody because of the look that they were given?
Well, the fact is that many people who act out violently use as their excuse later on, that person was rude to me, or that person did such and such, which is a way of not taking responsibility for one's action. There's nothing that I could do to you with a look that would justify my being killed. But with regard to your question, really I don't recommend that people turn around and stare at someone. What I do is recommend that you turn your head completely, take in everything, and look squarely at someone who concerns you, because it not only gives you information, but it communicates to him that you're not a tentative, frightened, you know, victim in waiting. I want to tell people that you are an animal of nature that's fully endowed with hearing and sight and intellect, and that you're not easy prey, so don't act tentative like easy prey. I do not, however, recommend staring someone down by any measure, just looking at them and taking in the information. And there is clearly a provocation that comes from staring at people. I mean, with a look alone, I could get into a fight with another man. And that's not what I'm recommending. But I am recommending don't be tentative. Look fully at someone so they know you see them.
Do you think that people should carry mace to protect themselves?
Well, mace is a product name for a particular kind of tear gas. If one is going to carry that type of, these are irritants that, you know, burn the eye and the face and affect the breathing, I prefer pepper spray, which is a better product, in my opinion, in that it works on a wider number of people in the population. I think it's a perfectly good thing. It gives you a slight advantage of removing someone's ability to see, and it causes a great deal of discomfort, and it's non-lethal. So I certainly don't oppose pepper spray.
If somebody is obviously addled because they're high on drugs, do you think that it's easy to assess what their behavior is going to be, or are all bets off there?
Well, I don't think in any circumstance all bets are off, because really if someone is in your environment who is a stranger, who makes you feel uncomfortable, and who's also high on drugs or alcohol, your prediction is done. Now it's a matter of what strategies you apply, but the element of predicting human behavior couldn't be any easier than when you have somebody in your environment who causes you discomfort and is high or drunk.
But I mean, in terms of deciding whether you should comply or find any way to run for your life, even if that person is threatening you with your life if you try to flee.
Well, it usually isn't a decision, interestingly, Terry. One of the premises of my work is that fear, true fear, which is the signal that occurs in the presence of danger, is a gift because it guides people through dangerous situations. I mean, I've got case after case of people who did extraordinary things, even literally a man who fights with a great white shark and wins on the basis of doing what fear told him without decision making. So many people talk about having completed their self-defense strategy, whatever it was, without even thinking about it. And there's a woman who tells me about following a man who would murder her silently down the hall. He doesn't know that she's behind him. And she told me later, I was a passenger moving on my own legs. I had nothing to do with it. Because fear says, in effect, shut up and do what I say and don't debate. And it's usually the strategies when it's true fear are over before people get to the decision-making mode. It's smarter than we are, in other words.
My guest is Gavin DeBecker, author of The Gift of Fear. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gavin DeBecker, an expert on how to protect yourself against the threat of violence. You've consulted with many people about stalkers. When do you typically get called in on a stalker case? How far has the situation usually progressed by the time you're called in?
I think the cornerstone characteristic of a case that involves our office is fear. When a victim feels in fear for their safety, that's usually when we're called, unless it's a prominent public figure, in which case they are often already clients because they are experiencing so many cases, and really there our chore is to identify which cases rise to the level of concern and which cases don't. But usually people involve our office when they are afraid.
Does the stalker typically want to be known or want to be invisible?
Both, depending on which type. I think there's a bold line that we can draw between two types of stalkers. Those that pursue media figures, which are the ones we read about often in the paper, and those that pursue regular people. And talking about those that pursue regular people, they are not usually attention seekers. They are usually attachment seekers. And, you know, the most common form of stalking is by estranged ex-husbands or people in relationships. And I know Americans are fascinated when a public figure is attacked by a stalker, but that happens about once every 3.5 years. a woman is murdered by a stalking ex-husband or ex-boyfriend once every 2 hours in America. And that's why you'll see in my work a great deal more focus on those kinds of stalking cases than on the ones that generally are interesting to the news media.
Well, if you're being stalked by an ex-husband or boyfriend or something, then the idea of ignore them and they'll go away is not going to work for you.
That's absolutely correct. I think if you are at a circumstance with an ex-husband or an ex-boyfriend where the pre-incident indicators that are associated with escalations of violence or even homicide are present, then you're in a situation where you need to make yourself unavailable to your pursuer, and there are many strategies for doing that. None of them are easy. The problem is we want someone to tell us, oh, it'll be all right, which is what our denial is telling us very often. And so, you know, literally several times every day, women are murdered in America who knew full well that they were in danger of being killed, but took advice that was easier to take than going to a battered women's shelter, which is really usually the thing to do if you're in a situation where you have a real safety hazard.
How effective do you think restraining orders are?
Well, I think it's a real serious part of this problem because if you went to a doctor and he said you've got to have immediate heart surgery because your life is in danger, or you can carry this piece of paper, of course, most people would say, oh, I'll take the piece of paper, doc. But where we are with a lot of these cases is that some of them involve women who are in immediate danger and their life is at risk, and yet they take a strategy which is the one that sounds simple and easy, carry this piece of paper. The fact is this, based on as many studies as I've been able to locate, about 2/3 of cases improve after getting restraining orders. About 1/3 do not improve, and in that population there are some that escalate to homicide. So it's very, very important that anybody who has the opportunity to communicate with potential victims makes this point clear. Restraining orders are right for some cases, very wrong for some cases, and the challenge is to know which kind of case yours is.
Is that what your job is?
Absolutely. Both my job in my work and in my work with, I'm the co-chair of the Domestic Violence Council Advisory Board, and my job in public education, which I'm doing that job right now, is to make clear that restraining orders are right for some cases, very wrong for others, and to identify the characteristics associated with where it'll help. And the answer is usually resides in the victim, which is asking the victim, how do you think he's going to react to this? And if the victim says, I think he's going to be afraid to be arrested and he's going to leave me alone forever, then that's the right strategy. But if the victim says, I think he's going to react angrily and possibly escalate, then it is the wrong strategy. And we've got a country now that is recommending restraining orders wholesale, 1,000 a day issued in the United States. And news agencies and local news always saying, here's how you get a restraining order if you're being stalked, instead of, should you get a restraining order if you're being stalked? Because it's not right for every case.
Do you think it's as simple as asking the person who's being stalked what they think the impact of the restraining order will be on their spouse or boyfriend?
No, it's not as simple as that, but that person, in that person resides the best information in terms of intuition. And then there are about 40 other things that I talk about that one would measure in these cases to determine if a restraining order is the best strategy. The real problem is that we can't, and yet we do, too often diagnose a situation on the basis of one characteristic. I mean, can you imagine if a caller called in and said, I have chest pains, would any doctor in the world say, oh, okay, here's what you do, and give a prescription or a treatment plan? Yet, ironically, women are calling, you know, radio shows and police departments and lawyers all over the country and saying, I'm being stalked by my angry ex-husband. What should I do? And people are actually willing to give a treatment plan without a diagnosis. And that's why women every day are being killed, and in their, you know, personal effects is a restraining order. So clearly it's not right for every case.
I'm wondering, because you deal with so many violent people, do you walk out of your house and just see the potential violent person wherever you are? Are you always picking that person out whose behavior is cluing you that they might erupt?
Terry, it's a good question, but the answer is it's literally the opposite. I am blessed to live a fairly fear-free life because my philosophy about fear is that it is a signal that will sound in the presence of danger. So I needn't invent nor have worry or anxiety about things that might happen. You know, people who are focused on what might happen instead of what is happening tend to not only be more anxious and have a lot more worry and anxiety in their lives, but also less safe. Because if you're saying, gee, somebody could climb out from behind that bush or behind that car, you're not perceiving what's actually going on. And unwarranted fear will kill more Americans this year than violence will. Striking to say, I know, but the fact is there is more fear in America than there is danger. And what I've really focused on in my work is how you tell the difference between true fear, which you want, that's a survival signal in the presence of danger, and unwarranted fear, which is anxiety and worry and all of those things that you don't want. And in this culture, it's very, very hard to do because the local news is selling us a diet of all the ways we might die and the urgency, you know, with which they tell us you must learn this information.
Gavin De Becker, he's the author of The Gift of Fear, which was recently published in paperback. Coming up, a review of the new movie Your Friends and Neighbors. This is Fresh Air. Your Friends and Neighbors is the new dark ensemble comedy written and directed by Neil LaBute, whose first film was In the Company of Men. John Powers has a review.
Is it possible to dislike a movie and still think it's good? That's what I found myself asking after I saw Your Friends and Neighbors, the new movie by Neil LaBute, who scored a scandalous success with In the Company of Men, the overpraised tale of two misogynist businessmen who set out to break the heart of a pretty deaf secretary. Your Friends and Neighbors is also about twisted sexual relationships, but LaBute has upped the ante. His canvas is broader, his message even darker. This time, the women are nasty, too. The movie's a baleful modern version of a restoration comedy. It traces the amorous escapades of six people, all with rhyming names. Ben Stiller is Jerry, a garrulous drama professor who lives with Terry, played by Catherine Keener, an acid-tongued writer of ad copy. He decides to cheat on her with Mary, played by NYPD Blues Amy Brenneman. Mary's the dissatisfied wife of Jerry's best friend, Barry, played by Aaron Eckert, a paunchy lug who finds his own greatest satisfaction in masturbation. Meanwhile, Terry, are we getting lost yet, falls into bed with Nastasia Kinski's character, Cherie. A soft-spoken gallery worker, she's the antithesis of Carrie, that's Jason Patrick, a woman-hating womanizer who reviles one lover for getting menstrual blood on his designer sheets. Over the course of the movie, these six constantly rub up against one another, joking, bickering, philosophizing, selling each other out, and engaging in some of the most joyless lovemaking this side of a Graham Greene novel. It's a bleak portrait of sexual life, and it held me rapt. The movie marks a real cinematic advance for LaBute. It's far better shot and edited than In the Company of Men, and it's filled with pungent performances like Stiller's Jerry, a wannabe Lothario who talks a good lay but can't cut the mustard, and Keener's hilariously exasperated turn as Mary, who wishes Jerry would just shut up when they're having sex. LaBute has a knack for doing loathsome, and the movie's filled with crisp, lacerating set pieces, crackling with wicked jokes and malicious twists. The most loathsome moments belong to the macho jerk Carrie, as when he explains to Jerry and Barry his theory of morality.
This girl tried to dump me once. So I got my hands in some hospital stationery, and I sent her this letter informing her that she had appeared on a list of previous partners of a patient of mine who had just tested HIV positive.
You did not do that.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
So you decide. The bitch deserved it. She never understood me. And it was a good joke. But am I good for doing it? If I know. All I do know is I did it. And I find a certain clarity in the gesture.
Don't you think we're gonna have to, you know, like, pay for all this in the end?
Possibly. I mean, if there ends up being a god or something like that whole eternity thing out there, then yeah, probably so. I don't know. We'll see. But until then, we're on my time. Okay? The interim is mine.
Your Friends and Neighbors is about people who use sex to find themselves, but get lost in their own slippery, tortured, often solipsistic psyches. And it's well worth seeing, precisely because it tackles subjects that most American movies ignore. Male self-hatred, women's desire, power relationships in sex, the difference between sleeping with someone and knowing who they are. These are real things that affect all our lives, not simply those in the Oval Office. There are enough true moments in Your Friends and Neighbors that I wish I could take seriously LaBute's grim diagnosis of sexual life. But frankly, it doesn't strike me as the work of a conscientious artist who has looked intently at human nature and discovered, to his great regret, that life is sordid. Too much of the movie's cynicism is cheap. It has the snide glee of a high school kid who keeps saying naughtier and naughtier things in order to shock us. LaBute's forever stacking the deck to make his characters uglier or more pathetic. If a husband genuinely loves his wife, LaBute will make sure that he can't help her achieve orgasm. If a guy can't perform in bed, LaBute will make sure that his partner is bitchy about it. He's like a heartless god who first compels his characters to be weak, then punishes them for their weakness. The movie ends with a thuggish Carrie in bed with a woman we never dreamed would consent to sleep with him. Why is she there? Not because of anything the movie has shown us about her, but because LaBute needs this final coupling to complete his pattern, to seal his idea that sexual relationships are inescapably soiled. The movie's champions might claim that such hyperbole is artistic license, but Your Friends and Neighbors uses such license to make sexual life seem crummy and hopeless. If these really are my friends and neighbors, then I'm the best lover on the planet.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.